All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter Podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter.
All right.
Another episode.
We're back. And we've got a guest this week. And I'm
two guests.
I'm really excited about it. Two guests at the same time. It's a really great episode. And we're going to get into Twitbits before we get to that. Megan, how are you doing? You've just been traveling all over the place.
Yeah, I have. I have been, I guess, recently. I was in Chicago seeing my family a few weeks ago, and we were in Montana before that. And then I went to LA last weekend. So I just flew in today.
Yes, to see Scott Okamoto, who we love, big friend of the show.
It was a great time. It was a blast. Check out his book. He was on an episode of Thereafter. But check out his book, Asian American Apostate. We went to his book launch, and a few of us flew down there, and people came kind of from other places, and we had a good time, and I'm excited about this book.
Yeah. Yeah, I have my copy. I've gotten into it a little bit. Scott was able to make a quick stop in Denver, and we got to have lunch a few weeks ago, and I got a copy,
See?
A signed copy. So
you get to see people too.
I do get to see people. People come see me, which is sweet. Anybody who wants to come see me in Denver, you are always welcome. I think Kevin Garcia is going to get out here this summer. I'm pretty excited about. So we'll see.
There you go.
I'm not traveling as much as I used to be. But
I kept joking throughout the weekend because there were six of us that had an Airbnb together. And I said it felt like an ex-evangelical real world, like MTV. Like I was like, where are the camera crews? Because it's just like throughout the weekend, that's just kind of what happens when, and we've had it before when we did the PDX meetup and other times that, you know, people have gotten together.
Yep.
But
strangers from all over, move into a house. Find out what happens when things start getting real. The real world.
I would say that I would be like, I feel like we cut to commercial, like coming up next. We deconstruct purity culture while we eat our pancakes. Like it was great. It was a good time, but it's just funny because when you're in that crew and in that setting, you do have these deeper conversations, and then you have, you know, it's funny and you laugh and it's healing and cathartic to kind of get it all out there and have everybody kind of just know deeply what you're talking about. So
yeah.
It was a good time.
Yeah. I've had several situations over the last few years where groups of internet friends come together in real life for whatever, a weekend or things like Wild Goose, things like our Portland meetup. We did a DRCK thing that I've talked about on here with the Dirty Rotten Church Kids, people from the Discord way back in the day. And it's not for everybody, but like there is something really cool about getting a group of people who like have internet friendship and like getting together in real life. It's a wild phenomenon that I think is not something I ever would have thought was something that would happen, you know, if you asked me, you know, 10 years ago or maybe even 5 years ago. Like,
yeah, it's something I was talking to. If you don't follow Jazz Robertson on Twitter, she's awesome. And we got to see her a little bit in LA too, but we were talking about this because it is this interesting phenomenon. And the reality is Twitter people are people. and it's something that when, you know, it's maybe not legible to everyone that when you tell them about it and when you're hanging out, like, oh, how do you know each other? Oh, through Twitter. And maybe it seems strange, but at the end of the day, we're all people and we're all humans and humans that that have connection. And so it is this beautiful thing. And when you have been sharing space, and I'm maybe it's the way we have our, you know, deconstruction coffee hour and some of the dialogue and discussions that we've had, but you get together and it's like, you don't need any time. It's, you know, you show up and everybody kind of knows each other and dive in.
Yeah.
You know,
I think online community has changed a lot in the last, you know, 5 years with, you know, things like Spaces and Clubhouse, things like Discord servers and Patreons. You know, like I've known several people who have done camping trips or get togethers or big meetups with patron, you know, with other patrons from podcasts or from different fandoms where, you know, they know each other and they've shared space and community. I think, you know, the internet has evolved to this place where we've been able to create these niche communities online that give a level of safety and closeness and comfort that you didn't maybe used to have with just maybe a MySpace, you know, friend or, you know, a Facebook friend or something like that.
You didn't go on evangelical retreats with the people in your top eight in MySpace?
Eight. Oh man, that's what we should call one of our meetups, the top eight meetup. Everyone bring your top eight.
I feel like when we're trying to not platform folks, maybe calling it the top eight would be a little bit
misleading. Everybody
gets
a top eight. Everybody who comes gets to bring their top eight.
This is perfect. Yes. Well, it's interesting because I think there's, you know, we've talked about this on the pod, and I think there's times where I'm like, I don't know where all this is going and what we're really doing. And you know, I've kind of built a, I guess you could say, platform on Twitter. And I'm like, I don't know what it's doing. But as I sat in LA this weekend, I was like, if this is what it leads to, this kind of community, that's what I'm here for. That's where it's at. And I think just being able to, like, Scott Okamoto took us around Little Tokyo and out to restaurants. And it was just like being able to meet people, have experiences, try new food and just, you know, kind of explore together, but also like sit around a kitchen table and have deeper conversations is where it's at. And I think, but speaking of where is it all going and what are we doing on Twitter?
Where is it all going, Megan?
What are we going to do about the blue check marks? Let's have a conversation about this.
I think it's fascinating. I think that the change in, It is literally flipped a symbol upside down, what Twitter has done with the blue checks, because it within a really short period of time, within 6 months, 8 months, I don't know, when did, you know, the evil overlord take over? Not very long ago.
I don't remember.
It's not very long ago. And to have something that symbolic. You know, the blue check really was a, you know, I don't think it really is this big status symbol that a lot of people thought that it was. Maybe for some people it was. I had friends that had blue check marks. I had friends that had big platforms that didn't have blue check marks. And so, like, I don't know that it really was this, like, elite status symbol that people made it out to be. However, it did stand for, like, hey, this person has some legitimacy, you know, in this space. Like, they've established themselves in some sense, and it had some sense of credibility on the platform. And to completely erase that and completely change what that means so drastically, yes, in such a short period of time, is, because I literally don't, when I see a blue check mark, my initial thought is this person, it's negative. It's like, this person probably doesn't have, like, probably is not safe, which, like, I don't,
yeah.
I know there are reasons that people might have a blue check mark or might have blue for accessibility reasons or various other reasons. I'm not trying to shame anybody, but the symbolic meaning of what it means when you see it has completely done a 180 on the platform. And I think that that's fascinating to me.
Well, and it used to be, you are who you say you are. So somebody like, you know, Brad Pitt is on Twitter. The blue check is next to his name. You know, like, I don't even know if Brad Pitt's on Twitter, but the blue check is next to his name. And then somebody can't come on and just poses him and, you know, whatnot. And now, then it became also, like, I don't know if you saw what happened with NPR and, you know, I haven't
government funded media. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and then you have Elon tweeting out defund NPR. And so now you have even journalism that says, hey, this platform, we cannot share our stuff and feel like we have integrity about it. And so the verification of people being who they say they are is going away. And then journalists are going away because they can't share things anymore. And so I think it's just, you know, like whatever, like I get it. He's trying to monetize. I mean, I don't get it, but I see that he's trying to monetize, but he just has no long-term strategy at all. And plus, they don't even have the staffing. This is something I was talking to the Snarky Gent about. They don't even have the staffing to make the verify checks go away consistently. So now it's just like kind of chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have Elon paying personally for a handful of people to keep their blue check mark kind of as a troll, I guess. Like it's like his way of trolling Shatner and LeBron James and some other people. Stephen King, most notably, I think, got on Twitter, you know, the day after the whole blue check mark being gone. And he tweeted and said, you know, it says on my profile that I have Twitter Blue and that I paid for it and that I gave my phone number, but I have never done any of those things, so I'm not sure. And Elon replied, of course, and was like, I got you, bud. You know, and like he was like, that's kind of weird. Like, it's kind of weird. Like, like that.
Like, did I have consent like that to have a blue check?
Yeah, that you are like representing me in a certain way. And again, like, what does it mean, right? Like, because it's a symbol, right? It's a symbol of something that is rapidly changing what that means. I was having a conversation with a queer friend about undercuts. And she was talking about, like, having an undercut and, like, how it's like it used to be a lot more of a queer signaling thing, but a lot of straight women started doing it, and no shame, like no, not trying to gatekeep undercuts. I'm sure straight women have been doing that, but she was like, yeah, this used to be, you know, like this used to be more queer signaling, and now I find it, you know, to be less so. And in Colorado, I've talked to several of my lesbian friends. I remember my friend Jill, who is a listener, I don't know if she'll be listening, but she was like, Cortland, I can't, I don't know who to date in Denver. I walk around, everyone's driving Subarus, everyone's wearing Chaco sandals, everyone's wearing cargo shorts. I don't know who the lesbians are. It's like, these are all signs. Like, you are a woman with an undercut wearing Chaco sandals, cargo shorts, and driving a Subaru. I feel like I should be able to ask you out, at this point. Like, those are all lesbian things. Okay. And she's like, but straight women are doing that. But so when our signaling, when our symbols change really rapidly, it's interesting to watch people react. And it's interesting. It's been interesting to watch the big fanboys, the Elon fanboys, and the people who really love what's happening on Twitter talk about it, because it really shows how much they, how much stock they put in this like narrative that they're like being oppressed by some type of elite power, right? And I think that that's really been one of the things that has stood out to me, is like, oh, this really, you really do have this weird narrative that you've somehow been oppressed. And this, as stupid as it is that you paid $8 and got this blue check mark that now means really nothing, you feel like that's somehow a win for fighting back against this oppressive, elitist power system. And I think it just really shows how I had a tweet that said, like, the same people who mock others for like participation trophies are the same people really excited to pay for Twitter Blue and get a blue check mark. Like, yeah. like you live in a world that says, like, oh, well, you know, it shouldn't be about, you know, labels. Why does being gay have to be your whole personality? And it's like, dude, you literally like whined and now have a blue check mark because you needed a symbol to affirm you, like, because you don't feel affirmed.
Yeah. And I've seen people not only leave in droves, this whole like pay now for a blue check mark, because the blue check mark will now bump up how often people see you in their feed, where you are in the algorithm, how many likes you end up getting, how far your voice reaches. It takes away the equity that we had in Twitter. And I know even that wasn't great, but like here we have people that are, you know, have 130 followers that are have a blue check mark that, you know, they're like, because I have something to say and I want to do it on Elon's platform. And then, you know, my trans friends are DMing me privately, like, hey, here's my phone number to stay in touch because I don't feel safe here and I'm not going to use this platform anymore. And so it's like, that is making a shift, and I'm seeing that in my feed. And yes, there's still a lot of people on there. I'm still on there for like until it feels like it is too unsafe for the people that I interact with. But I do, I'm not going to pay for a blue check, but I do think it's just an interesting dynamic, and we're just kind of waiting for everything to burn down. I don't know. Like, that's kind of where I'm at. I'm like, okay, when's the day? We all saw it. Like, when the app was breaking, you know, it's like, oh, this is it. We're all saying goodbye. And then it trudged along. And now we're just like, I don't know. I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, for myself, it is, with all social media, it is a question of like, what, you know, we talk a lot about Twitter and the problems with, you know, Twitter specifically related to the Elon takeover and, you know, just like very outright undoing of any type of, you know, protections, taking away misgendering and dead naming from their policies, creating very intentionally unsafe space on the platform. But beyond that, we have Instagram and we have Facebook and we have these other big Reddit, these other big platforms. I don't know if you saw the interview that went somewhat viral with the founder, CEO, one of the founders from Substack, talking about Substack Notes or Substack. They're doing like a microblog platform.
They are doing kind of a feed.
Yeah.
Yes, I've seen that.
And then he was on a podcast or being interviewed, and there was a TikTok video that went viral, and it was a person of color doing the interview, and he was saying, he was like, well, like, what is, like, what are you going to allow? Like, are you not going to allow people to say on your platform that, like, brown people shouldn't be in the country, right? And this guy who was the founder or whatever just does a terrible job of being like, well, we think that we'd like, you know, to, you know, maybe create, you know, and he was like, can people be racist on your platform? Like yeah. He was like,
you got to think this through.
Like are people allowed to call me an animal as a person of color on your platform? Like, this should be an easy answer. This should not be a difficult question to answer. Like, are you allowed to advocate for my genocide on your platform? And this guy wouldn't answer. He wouldn't give a straight answer. Because, you know, they've done a ton of crowdfunding. They've done a ton of investment rounds. They have, you know, investors, big Silicon Valley investors who are investing in their platform. And many of them are in this Elon Musk community of people in Silicon Valley. And they're beholden to that money and to those investors and to being a platform that is not, you know, built on some sort of like virtue or, you know, what is good for the people who are using it. They're built on a idea that when people are racist, when people do things that are infuriating and create rage, that's good for clicks.
Yeah, it all goes back to, like, when it comes to harm reduction. I've talked about this before, but I have a whole piece that, like, some people don't give a shit about harm reduction, and then some people give a shit because they're like, I want to use the right language for PR reasons. I want to look good. I want to, you know, have my conference just look like we're doing it the right way. And then there's people that actually care and actually want to do good in the world and actually want humans to flourish and want harm to be reduced. And I think that people that are driven by capitalism and people that are driven that have not rooted out and done the work to understand white supremacy culture, like, just cannot be those people that are actually trying to root out have that harm reduction piece be who they are. And so when you have those conversations, they're like, they don't want to say it out loud, but it's like, well, I want to make money and this seems like a good opportunity. And I do have, I have to think about racism, like, huh. You know? And it'll be interesting to see how they navigate that.
It's capitalism. I mean, it is, we see today. I mean, just today we had Tucker Carlson being fired from Fox News. And
which won't hurt him in the end. Yeah. It's like, well, let's celebrate it for a minute, but you know that he's going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the announcement for his Daily Wire show. Like, I'm convinced that that's probably already set up, and that Matt Walsh and Ben Shapiro have already, you know, reached out, and they're going to have him on Daily Wire Plus or whatever the fuck they're...
they're probably having drinks right now.
Platform is. Yeah. Most likely. But the reality is, like, Fox News kept him on, you know, they just settled this big lawsuit for misinformation about the voting booths, the I forget the name of the company, all the election fraud stuff. They knowingly, and Tucker Carlson knowingly, in internal emails, he was like, yeah, this is not true, this is wrong, but, like, it's good for ratings, it's good for people, it's good for viewers. Viewers, people that are watching... are going to increase in watching more in when I say this ridiculous stuff that I don't even believe. You look at things like Bud Light and what they did with this campaign with Dylan Mulvaney that, you know, created this huge outrage from all of Kid Rock and all these stupid fucking alcoholic white men who got, you know, all up in arms about Bud Light. At the end of the day, like, it's rage farming. It is, like, I don't even think Bud Light is being, like, an ally. I just think that they're like, yeah, this is going to piss people off. Like, M&M's did it. Bud Light did it. Like, this is all about creating rage and creating clicks and creating earned media. And so that's why I say, I guess I just bring up that it's a broader problem. It's not just Elon. And I don't want to minimize Elon and Twitter and specifically what this platform has done, but also all these other platforms are, like, the systems. The systems are built in a way that is not healthy for us, for anybody using them. Mike Maharg was talking about this in his book, Your Miracle and a Pain in the Ass, back in 2018, I think, when that book came out. Maybe 2019, something like that. And it's why Mike Maharg is, like, not on any social media anymore, because he was like, this is literally fucking our brains up. And for all the good that I think does come out of a lot of our social media interactions and the people we meet and the community that we have, we have to be aware that we're living in and we're operating in systems that are set up to not to create healthy individuals, but to create revenue.
Yeah. And a couple of things. I do want to kind of, like, we talked about, you mentioned alcoholic white men, and I think there is, like, a whole track we could go on about alcoholism and mental health and things like that I won't dive into now, but
fair point. I don't want to mischaracterize, and I think you bring up a good point there. It's just many of these men who got on and raged about Bud Light, I was like, listen, like maybe not any other beer. Maybe let your relationship with Bud Light be the end of your relationship with beer in general, because it's 9 a.m. and you're restocking your mini fridge. So
yeah, and to prove a point. But I will also say that we rage about this and we talk about this, and there's toxicity. But what we're trying to do here with the podcast and what we're trying to do in these spaces, like with Twitter spaces and all of that stuff, is find those corners where there is beauty and connection and build community. And I think that's why we're sticking around, even though the algorithm is starting to stack more and more against us. And, you know, it's just like, well, if we can still make those connections, if we can still be a safe space, or strive to be a safe space. I know you can never like guarantee, but if we can still strive to open spaces that we work at to make safe spaces, then we're still going to do it. And so, yeah, people can rage and people can go do, you know, we can see these toxic takes. We can see Tucker Carlson just making shit up and spewing it out there and intentionally causing harm. And then I think in the meantime, we'll just kind of keep on trucking in the realm of the Twitter sphere where we are, and just hope that we can continue to make beauty, you know?
Yeah. Well said. I think that's a perfect way to lead right in to our interview.
Yeah. We don't have a lot that we can say that won't be said in the interview, but I am so damn excited to share this with our listeners because I know everyone will get a lot out of it, no matter what stage of life. This is like a mother-daughter inner conversation, but I think whether you're a parent, whether you're not a parent,
whether you have
the
parents,
way that you relate to your parents, yeah. Everybody had a parent. So, I mean, I think anyone in any stage of life is going to get a lot out of this conversation about sex positivity and purity culture and family dynamics. And I just, yeah. Let's just dive in.
Yeah, Dr. Tina and her daughter Chloe on the show today. Let's get into it. We are back with another episode. Really excited about this interview. Megan is here with me. Cortland, your host.
Hey, everybody.
One of your hosts here. Megan, your other host. Welcome, Megan. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
We have guests. Do you want to intro our guests?
We have guests. Yeah. We've got Dr. Tina Schimmer-Sellers here today and her daughter, Chloe, and we are so pumped about this interview. I actually, spoiler alert, got to hang out with them recently.
I know.
And
Megan, listen, you get to hang out with everybody. I get it. Everyone's in the P&W. Everyone can fucking hang out with you. I get it. No, I'm just,
right,
I'm sorry.
Right.
It's a little
enough
FOMO.
With the FOMO.
Welcome, Dr. Tina and Chloe. Say hello.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here with you guys. This is like, I was looking forward to this.
Yeah, this is awesome. First podcast, so getting that under the belt.
Awesome. I mean,
nice.
I feel often like it's the first one every time. Every time I get on the mic, I feel like I'm doing this for the first time. So we're all in the same boat.
Well, one thing that we usually start with is we love our guests to give a little bit of context of who they are and kind of what their faith shift has been. But I kind of want to start with Chloe this time. Chloe, just let us know a little bit. Introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, I'm Chloe Sellers, Dr. Tina's daughter. Yeah, I grew up in Seattle, went to Seattle Pacific University, evangelical liberal arts college. Before that, went to Westmont College, but we don't really talk about that. It was gnarly time. But yeah, I mean, my faith journey has been really interesting because I was raised in faith communities, but definitely not your average evangelical purity culture stuff. Like, I had a sex therapist for a mom who was very open, and we could talk about anything at home and nothing was shameful. So yeah, I mean, I've been in it to win it the whole time, but have not, I walked away with very little religious trauma, which is awesome.
Yeah. That's
love that.
That is in contrast to the way I grew up, That's very fucking cool. And I'm really excited to hear more about what that must have been like. because I have a very different story, and I think a lot of our listeners probably do as well. So Dr. Tina, what was your background before getting into what you're into now?
Well, I grew up in a Swedish immigrant home, and it was fairly non-religious. And my grandparents were immigrants from Sweden. And so there were generations upon generations of people that were very body positive and sex positive. They wouldn't have even thought about it that way. They would have just thought they were the way they were. But the reality was, is that everyone, literally grandparents, aunts and uncles, great aunts, whatever, they would all talk about sexuality as it would naturally emerge. And it would be for a second, you know, be in response to something, and then it would be over. And I was literally in my 30s before I realized that not every family was like mine. I mean, I actually just thought everybody talked. I mean, you talk about health and you talk about your noses and you talk about how to make spaghetti or you talk, you know, and talking about sexuality and bodies was just right in there. In the mid 70s, so I'm 62, in the mid 70s, we moved from the Pacific Northwest, from Seattle, down to Southern California, and it was the middle of the Jesus movement. And whether people realize it or not, I think church in America is a reflection of what's happening sociopolitically. And so at that particular time, it was kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was, you know, as far as the church goes, it was, oh, Jesus is all about love. He's all about forgiveness. And it doesn't matter what your background is. In fact, the more drugs you've been on or whatever, the more we're going to love you and be there for you. And it was very much the beginning of what later we called the CCM kind of movement with all the music. It was the very beginning of that. You know, so we'd go to concerts every Saturday night, a bunch of my friends, and half the people there were higher than a kite. And they were fabulous. They were wonderful. And I thought, oh, I'm all about this Jesus dude because he's all about the things I care about, you know, justice and standing up for people that are underrepresented and whatnot. And so I became a Christian. I was the one in my family who became a Christian. But it was this really lovely, simple faith for me. And wow. In 1980, as everything began to turn to the right, I kept looking at what the church was doing and thinking, I don't think that's Jesus. I don't think Jesus is going there with you. And in fact, it's really offensive to me. So I'm just going to stand right here where I've always been. And what ended up happening is I began to look more and more radical and more sort of anti-Christian, but just because I was not all of those things. I didn't make it about condemning people. I didn't make it about what's your belief and what's not your belief. It was just for me about justice and love and taking care of each other and pretty simple. And so I just kind of feel like I've been more and more sidelined and watched as the crazy shit's been going down in the last 40 years. It's mind boggling because we continue to be further and further away from where we actually were in the 70s with regard to kindness. I mean, listen to the music. Love the one you're with was actually love the one you're with. It wasn't fuck the one you're with or take advantage of the one you're with. Or it was really, it doesn't matter if you don't know each other, you're going to take care of each other, right? It was just a different time. It was a different time. And I think my story actually isn't a whole lot different than people like Brian McLaren's, who was kind of in that movement when he was younger. And it looks different than his parents, you know, but people who are my age who have crossed over with Christianity had a really different experience than after the legalism that started in the 80s and has continues to this day.
Yeah.
It's more and more crazy.
I think it's super interesting you bring up like the Jesus movement, and like it's been interesting to watch like the rewrite of that origin story, like since, you know, many of those, you know, Lonnie Frisbee is not around anymore, yeah, and Rich Mullins and Keith Green and a lot of these guys who were a part of that are not here anymore and weren't really here to see it turn into what it did with the later Calvin right. Chapel movement and the, yeah, you know, religious right becoming this powerhouse in the 80s and the 90s. And even with like, there's that movie that just came out about, you know, Jesus Revolution, I think is what it's called or whatever. And like they, you know, really rewrite like, you know, the story. I think Lonnie Frisbee in that movie is like married and they don't address his sexuality at all. And like it, all of those things, it's like trying to kind of like make it into something that it really wasn't, because it really was a very different narrative than what you see it turned into.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think the saddest part when you look back on it is that there were people like Lonnie and many, many others who felt like they needed to stay in the closet.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's definitely a part of that. There's a, I mean, you know, like, again, it's a reflection of what was going on in culture, you know? But at the same time, it was the same time as, like, Studio 54 was going on. So I would go out dancing every Wednesday night down in Anaheim with a bunch of my friends. I would, like, make my clothes. I looked very hot, like, very
there's
hot.
There's no doubt.
And I would, I would dance the night away with random people, and I never once was inappropriately treated, not once. And I was 18, so you could go in at 17 even, like going in my junior year. Never once. And I can tell you during this, I had some single years between my two marriages, and that was not the case. That was not the case then, not at all. And Chloe and I had lots of conversations about the world that she lives in, you know, that she's had to learn to date in. It's just not the world I lived in. I just didn't even think about that stuff.
Well, and I'm curious, just because Chloe, you mentioned, you know, not having the purity culture that a lot of your peers had, and then going to a school like Westmont and then Seattle Pacific. And I'm curious, just like going from that environment, were you then drawn towards more rigidity, I guess, or like, what was that like? Or did you
She's shaking her head. No.
Always, yeah. Did you like always feel like, okay, I have like kind of like you said, Tina, like I'm going to kind of stand here while I watch everybody else just kind of be a little bit off about things. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think my time at Westmont was bizarre because like even in Seattle, because it's so progressive and forward thinking, even in evangelical spaces, there's some more wiggle room and a little bit less like condemnation and stuff. And so I wasn't expecting to go down to Southern California and experience the like Christian right that existed there and that it was so political. And so like, yeah, I wanted to be like a fly on the wall and just witness this like other world of people that like, I mean, these were like 18, 19 year olds who did not know how babies were made. Like they had zero idea. And were just like so full of shame and just like hated themselves. And so I tried to just like be a fly on the wall, but you know, you grow to love people. And so found myself having these like small educational sessions with people where I'm like, okay, hey, like, let's talk about it. How are babies made? Let's like do this. Did get in trouble for that, but like, it was really hard not to get involved because I think, you know, I mean, not only did I grow up in a very open home about this, but it was a very educational home. And so like my friends in middle school, I went to Catholic school up until college. And my friends would come over to dinner at my mom's house and would be able to ask these questions at the dinner table that like they didn't get to have at home. And so I was constantly around not only conversations about sex, but like educating people about it. And then I found myself in a place where like they didn't know the basics. They didn't know the names of their own body parts. Like it was gnarly. It was really, really rough. So.
Yeah, I think you hit on something really interesting there, because I think in absence of education, like there is just this like cultural purity culture. We talk a lot about evangelical purity culture and like the, you know, obviously I Kissed Daddy Goodbye and like this like Christian bookstore narrative that was going on in the 90s and 2000s. However, like I think that there was a fair amount of people that maybe didn't get that, but just didn't get education. And so reverted to almost like this like de facto purity culture in absence of having any real education or information. And I guess I'd love to hear, Chloe, you talk a little bit about the, I think there is this narrative that was crafted for me that like education was an enemy. It was something to be afraid of, because if you educate, if you told people how to have sex or what sex was, then they're going to just do it like crazy. And, you know, like you just want to keep them. What was your experience in terms of growing up with an open and like a source of education and your experience with your own sexuality and your own experience?
Yeah. I mean, I think like, I'm making all these faces thinking people can see me, which I think is funny.
Faces are seen on the episode. You can describe them.
But yeah, like the idea that education is the dangerous thing is so wild to me. You know, it's like the same with like, let's not talk about being gay because you're going to turn someone gay. Like learning about something, if anything, is a protective measure. And that became so clear to me in my own stuff, and then seeing the people I went to school with, because when you like lay on top, so if you've got like lack of education around your own sexuality and just anatomy and how you work, and then layer on top of that a culture that tells you that like men should chase women and that women are going to say no, but like the men should keep trying, and that like they know more than women do, and like men enjoy sex and women don't, and like we've got a culture that is educating us constantly about sex. And so if we don't give actual sex education, like, you know, I mean, we all know what happens, right? It's like rape culture and all this gross stuff. But so I think for me, having the education was super important. It wasn't just anatomy. It wasn't just like, yeah, that stuff was very open and talked about in my home. And it is now. Like I have two nieces who are 3 and 5, and we all use the right terminology. We talk about our body parts openly. Like, so that stuff was super helpful. But I think there was another layer of education around pleasure and desire that is really missing. Even in like basic sex education that we teach in certain schools, we're not talking about like you deserve pleasure because you are worthy, or like desire is a very positive thing. When you feel desire, that is your creative energy. Like that's a beautiful thing. It means you're alive. Being able to talk about those things meant that like I got to walk into my life knowing that about myself, like knowing that like I deserve pleasure, right? It is not my job to make someone else feel good, right? Like if I'm going to be engaged with someone, it's because I want to feel good and I want them to feel good and I want to connect with this person, and sex can be transcendent. All of those things, like all of that came from growing up in a house that just talked about it all the time.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. I'm curious for Tina, when you're, because I, like just kind of where you were and how you were having these conversations and having this openness, how was that perceived by the people around you? What kind of context were you in? And, you know, having an ability to have Chloe's friends ask you questions and just like, be kind of a resource for all of this. Like how was that received?
You know, there are probably things I didn't ever know. You know, like, you know, parents weren't calling me up saying, how dare you? But that wasn't happening. And like Chloe said, she went through Catholic schools all the way through in Seattle, which is very, very progressive. And it tends to be a kinder community just in general than the evangelical community as a whole is usually. And yet, I don't know. I think I just felt like these kids, if they had a question, they deserved a respectful, honest, knowledge-based answer. If they were smart enough to ask the question or curious enough to ask the question, then they deserved a respectful answer. And so I was happy to do that. You know, I mean, and I started out my career teaching in junior high and high school and taught sexuality then, you know. So I just have a lot of respect for kids and when kids have questions that they deserve answers. So, and I really can't think of, I mean, I can think of one time that Chloe had a friend, but I think her mom was probably more upset with me because her daughter wanted to come, like, live with us for a while. You know, it wasn't so much around sexuality. It was that there was so much strife at home, you know, so that was one. And then we had some good friends, and we'd go camping every single year. And since the kids were bitty, and there was a time when they were adolescents, and a couple of the cousins came out from Midwest, and I took the kids all skinny dipping, and I think I was seen as a little bit out there, but I was like, well, I'm here to keep you guys safe. You know, if you want to see what it's like to skinny dip, great, go for it. See what it's like. I'll make sure that nothing happens, you know? So I was always that, you know, that aunt or that good friend, you know, but people tolerated me, I think, laughed me off. I also think I was, you know, like, they were uncomfortable as parents talking to their kids, and I wasn't. And I think it was just like, well, let's just let Tina do it. In fact, my very best friend, who died 10 years ago, she used to say to her kids, you want to talk about anything about sexuality, you go talk to Tina. She'll talk to you about it, you know? So I think it was a little bit of a both and. I think I was both a little bit, I worried people, but then they also were grateful that I was around, I think, too. I don't know. What do you think, Chloe?
Yeah, I mean, I never got the impression that that you were stepping on anyone's toes. Like, I think parents, especially from the Catholic school, I think they were like stoked that my friends would come over and get to ask you so they wouldn't have to answer it.
Yeah.
You know, that was always the impression I got.
Yeah. I can remember one time we were at a graduation so I was teaching graduate school at the time, and a bunch of my students were, you know, they would have an event at the end of every year. And Chloe came for years to this graduation because it was just a really fun little, like, dinner or whatever, you know, and stuff. And yeah, it was really fun. And one time she and I were sitting at a table, and across from us was a mom of a, like, a 25-year-old, right? And I said something about, I think I was being teased on stage or something, and I said something about, yeah, I raised my kids talking about sexuality and making sure they had the education. And she said, like, I can't imagine that would be horrible. That would just mean that they would just do it. And I said, that's actually not true. And it's not supported by research either, you know? And I think both Chloe and I were like, there it is right there in front of us, you know, the very thing.
Yeah. I think one question that I have as a parent and as somebody who wants to, like, create those open dialogues, I think that there is this, and I don't know if it's just like cultural or if it's just like just natural, just like there's this sense that I think kids oftentimes don't want to ask questions or don't want to talk about things. And I don't know if you have advice for, like, ways in which to model. Like, I know I've had a lot of situations with my kiddo where, like, he'll be a little bit curious, and then maybe I, like, take it, like, you know, what is sex? And I'm like, oh, well, sex can, like, be, like, for fun, or it can be for procreation. It can be, like, two adults. It could be, like, three adults. You know, like, I'm like, it could be two guys, two girls, or non-binary person. And then he's like, okay, Dad, like, that's, like, all, that's enough. I don't need to know anymore. And I think I kind of maybe overwhelm him a little bit. How do you create an environment where, like, you're not ignoring these things, you're allowing them to come up, but you're not also, like, overwhelming them with, like, everything that can possibly be? Any advice you have would be awesome, because I'm lost.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to jump in here, Chloe? I wrote a book on it, so.
I mean, you wrote a book on it. I think you should jump in here. I didn't have to get up.
But I think the short answer, Cortland, really is it helps to know what kids at different ages want to know and can handle. And so you're just giving them that soundbite. And it's for you, and from where you come from, it's never all the information. So in that way, it might feel weird, you know, because you're like, I want you to have all the information. But all the information isn't what they're able to take in at that moment when they're like 4 or 6 or 8 or 10 or whatever. And so usually by the time they're 12, they're able to handle a whole lot of stuff. And that's usually right before, if they're going to start pushing away and wanting more influence from their peers, they're going to start doing that 12, 13, 14, you know, around in there. So I think it's finding that balance of giving them just what they need and then saying, you know, dude, if you've got any more questions, I'm totally happy to give you more. I just don't want to overwhelm you. There's a lot about being grown up, and sexuality is a lot of parts of our life, you know, and just kind of keep, you know, kind of dropping that little bit in there.
It's funny. I'll say, I have been watching through the show Friends with my kids. And it's almost like I call it sex education according to Friends, because they just ask questions as situations come up, and the show itself doesn't always handle it in the best way. But there's a lot of teachable moments when there's like some things that haven't aged well from that show. And I definitely like make sure to point those things out too. And I just think it's interesting because I have seen that curiosity. And I think once we've normalized, like, I think the biggest thing is like not shaming the question, right? Because I think that like creating that environment is to say like every question is on the table, and not having a reaction like how, like, That's the most uncomfortable thing that I would ever talk about or whatever, you know. And there was an episode about threesomes. There's an episode where like one of the characters can't perform, you know, and the kids have questions about that. And it's interesting to see like how different it is once you welcome and embrace, like, and maybe it's not all the information, but I'm curious because it sounds like that's the environment that you created where it was just like conversation, like, no question is off the table. And I'm curious, how, like, was that just, did that feel natural for you? It sounds like just with your upbringing, bringing Tina, that you were like, this is just who I am. Was there ever any point where you're like, I have gotten into this conversation and this is a tricky one to navigate? Or did you just kind of always just answer the way you felt natural?
Yeah, I would say probably because that's the way I was treated by my parents. I could tell you many stories of things that were like sound bites that were said by grandparents or aunts and uncles, or my father for that matter, you know, all the way through high school. And it was on the table. So because it was like any other conversation that you might have, even the harder ones, you know, that there wasn't shame involved, you know? And so like, if the kids did something that I was confused by or concerned about, then I would say, well, tell me about why that was your best decision. You know, like, help me understand. Give me a window into you, you know. It wasn't like there weren't hard conversations. I mean, there were hard conversations along the way for sure. But most of this, that was usually mid-late adolescence often, you know, when they were learning and making their own decisions about things, you know. But I don't know. I just think we must be partially meant to learn through our experience, because our prefrontal lobe isn't done cooking until we're like 25 or 28. And we've made a lot of decisions by then, you know. So I think you give them everything you can, and then you're like, all right, now you get to decide. You get to, Chloe's heard me say this, you know, I talk about, you get to write your sexual narrative. This is your narrative. It's not mine. I wrote mine. I've been writing mine. You know, you're writing your own. And what will be a narrative that you're going to be happy with for you? And how will you know? You know, and just, I think by the time they were 11, 12, 13, I was asking way more questions than I was giving information, because I'd already given so much information. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, right? That's great.
Yeah, I have a question for Chloe. I'm curious about like your experience as somebody who is, you know, said here, like, I didn't have the type of religious trauma and purity culture trauma. How has that been for you in relationships and in maybe engaging with other people who do have that, what are the advantages? And then also maybe what are some of the things that have been difficult when maybe, you know, being in relationship or pursuing relationship with somebody who does have that type of trauma or had a very different experience? Do you find that that has impacted the way that you've connected with people or created different situations in your relational experience?
I mean, I wish I had a good answer for this, but I'm like trying to think through, and I haven't really partnered with very many people that came from the church. And I don't know that that has been on purpose. Part of it, I think, is, you know, living in downtown Seattle and now living in Portland. Like, you guys know, like, my generation, we're all leaving the church. So I haven't had a lot of experience. I think I definitely have friends that have been through that. But no, I mean,
yeah,
that's a good enough answer for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's great. I am curious, like, because one of the things that I want to ask about, and I'm curious both your perspectives, because one of the things that I get pushed back on when I tweet about purity culture and when I talk about purity culture is that I believe that one of the biggest things about purity culture was the prescriptive ethic, quote unquote, biblical ethic of abstinence until you're married. Right. And a lot of people that are trying to create this space of conversations about, like, talking back to purity culture, maybe we should say, would say, that the problem with purity culture was the shame. And there's a lot of people out there, even in the deconstruction world, I'll say, that think like, oh, you know, let's adhere to this ethic, but let's just remove the shame piece. And so I would love to have you speak to that a little bit, because I know, like, Tina, you and I have talked about this before, but I think that there's this element there where I think from a parenting perspective, I think parents kind of want to have this ethic that they feel comfortable with, because they feel like they're, I don't know, quote unquote, protecting their children in, you know, as long as they possibly can, and until they can, you know, hand them off to a spouse. And so I would just love for you to speak to that a little bit, and just what that's like to kind of shed that, those rules and in that prescriptive piece of it.
One of the things I'll just say right up front, I think part of the reactivity that you see in so many people who grew up in purity culture is really a trauma response, because their sexuality from pre-verbal, you know, from finding their penis or their clitoris at 10 months old, at getting their diapers changed, and the hundreds and hundreds of times that they expressed that desire for pleasure, right, because we're human, and they got yelled at or hand slapped away or whatever, you know, it goes way back. And so it really is a form of complex trauma or sexual abuse. The developing sexuality was hurt multiple times. And so when it gets a language wrapped around it or a construct wrapped around it that says, don't have sex before marriage or it will ruin your life and ruin your relationship, that just gets wrapped around this trauma. It's the words that get wrapped around, like the wrapping on the present. It's not what's inside. I mean, what's inside is trauma, but it just got wrapped in this language, right?
Yeah.
We make all kinds of decisions. And I used to say to my kids when they were growing up, there is no such thing as a mistake if you turn it into a lesson. If you don't turn it into a lesson, then you're likely to repeat it, which is a drag for you, right? Because it's, you know, going to hurt you in some way, but in a way that you'll recover from. But this is life. This is what life is, right? And so, yes, your kids are going to do things and they're going to turn and say, that wasn't the best decision. Here's what I learned from that. And it could involve sex and sexuality. It could involve friendships, kinds of friendships you've had. It could involve decisions you made to drive a car when you shouldn't have. Who knows? I mean, a million things, right? Those are all opportunities to learn something. There isn't anything worse about making a mistake sexually than other mistakes that we make, right? That we can be like, oh, yeah, that person didn't treat me the way I want to be treated. Yeah, I learned something there. That ain't happening again. Here's what I'm going to do about that. Or I got to learn to stand up for myself or speak for myself or not put myself in that situation. Not because I made that happen to me, but because we live in a world that that's unsafe. You know, it's that unsafe. So I just think, but I think so many parents from purity culture can't even imagine their child making certain, you know, sexual decisions different than what they might want them to make because it just feels so life threatening, you know, and it's not necessarily life threatening. You know, it is, yeah, maybe you got hurt emotionally. Maybe you got hurt physically. But maybe you just got your heart broken, you know? Okay, this is part of living. It's part of learning, you know? And I actually think it is much more dangerous to not give your child education around who they are, their body, what's true, what isn't true, what's happening in our culture, how we sell people, how we make products more important than people. We believe in assaulting women right and left. You know, not give them any of that. And then wonder, why do they get exploited and they don't come home and tell you about it?
Yeah.
Right? You have made yourself unsafe, and now they've been really hurt. I mean, I remember I'll just tell a little story, but Chloe did a study abroad in New Zealand, and I went to visit her, spoke at a conference there, and then we hung out for a week and had a lot of fun. But she was with a bunch of students from other CCCU schools around the country, and many of them from Messiah back east, which was a really lovely, actually, pretty progressive CCCU school. And I can remember sitting down with one of her friends because she had come to Chloe and then asked if she thought I would talk to her. Of course I would. But she proceeded to talk about having been in an abusive relationship for over a year, but she couldn't tell anybody because she would get so blamed and shamed for what she was in. And so all I did was hear it, affirm that she did not deserve to be treated that way, ask her how she wanted to be treated, ask her how she imagined she could extricate herself from it, because this is the first time she was away from this person, you know? And so we put together a strategy and a plan. And I mean, I treated her like a bright young woman and gave her the information that she needed and helped her strategize and said, it's nothing about you that you got in this relationship. It's that you weren't protected before so that you could figure it out sooner and get yourself out sooner because you had no safe person to go to, no one to go to. And so she kept blaming herself and staying in it, right? And that's what I think is the danger. It's like, are you kidding? In a world like we have now, you're not going to prepare your child. That's like going out and climbing a mountain in sub-zero weather and not taking any equipment and any clothing with you. Like, seriously? So, I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah. I get on myself. You have to forgive me.
No, that's so good. I'm curious, Chloe, if you have anything to add or respond with any of that.
No, I agree. I think to what you were saying, Megan, like, I can't imagine an abstinence-only approach that doesn't include shame. I don't think there's a way to separate those two things because there's not enough nuance in an abstinence-only approach. Like, you know, how many people do we know who have strong faith and were in committed partnerships, not married, and like sex was a good choice, like great choice for them, right? And so I just can't imagine how you can separate those two things and say like, yeah, we're going to do abstinence only in my house, but like no shame allowed. It's not how that works. So yeah. I think what my mom said is absolutely correct, that the danger is like you become unsafe. And I mean, you know, I want to say that like having grown up with the openness in our home does not mean that I didn't have super harmful sexual experiences. But what always remained the same was that my mom was a safe person. And so I could go to her and say, you know, XYZ happened and I need help processing and moving forward. And there was never shame. It was not like, how did you get into this situation? It was, what do you need? And how are we processing it? You know, and I think that's the big piece, right? Is you can raise your kid perfectly. You can talk about all this stuff. You can have an open conversation every single day. And they're still going to go out into the world. And the world is fucked. Like, we are teaching boys not to process their emotions ever, unless it's anger. And we're teaching girls not to speak up for what they need or have boundaries. Right? Like, you can raise your kid perfectly. They're still going to go out there and fuck each other up. And so you need to remain safe, because they're going to need to come to you and say, like, this happened, and not be afraid that you're going to be mad at them for just existing in a really messed up world, you know?
Yeah. I can remember when Me Too broke and Chloe picked me up from the airport and we went out, and she was just telling me what had been going on, and I was telling what I had heard while I had been gone. And then I said, so tell me, you know, like, and so we got into experiences that she had had, because they even came to light more as this stuff came to light, right? And I'm just echoing what Chloe says. You can do everything you can to protect your children, which I believe is giving them education. Like, you're going to drive a car, I'm going to give you driver's ed. I want you safe out there. You know, you're going to do it all. And accidents can still happen, right? People can still get in car accidents, you know? Things can still happen. It's then, are you there to be like, how do I help you? What do you need? You know? Because we live in a really hard place to live.
And I think I want to get to what you have, Cortland, but I just want to, while we're on this track, I think there's the combination of, like, with the lack of education. I know there were experiences that happened to me that I didn't even process until I had the language to verbalize, like, oh, wait, this is why that was harmful and uncomfortable. And I didn't have that understanding of, like, this was a non-consensual experience that you had back then 5 years ago, you know? And so I think there's that. But then I also think that the lack of education is pushing out people that without that understanding of consent, like, it happens with victims and it happens with abusers too. And I think things happen and people, all parties, don't realize. And I think that's the danger of just zero education, is like, how do you even then respond? How do you even understand or build a framework of understanding when there was two people in a situation that really didn't understand how this happens, and then have no kind of construct to be able to know what's really happening, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And we have had many conversations around that exact point, that this isn't just education to protect women, while it is. It's also, you know, I mean, I've been in situations where I have had to educate a man post-assault because he didn't know that's what he had done. And that's a problem, right? Like, this is not excusing people, but it is calling out a system that is not teaching people how to care for each other, and is teaching people that something means yes that does not mean yes. So I 100% am with you. Like, it's not just for victims. It's we're also not teaching people how to consensually be together on either end.
Yeah.
I think I had another thing, but just, like, off of that particular, and I've mentioned this, I think, on the podcast before, but, like, one of the conversations that I've had with my son that's been really important to me was the fact that, like, being touched isn't invitation to touch, and, like, that was an experience I had as a teenager where I was in an encounter and I was being touched, and then I would try to touch, and then I was told no, and then I was touched, and then I would try to touch, and I was told no, and I kept not hearing the no because I was perceiving their touch as an invitation to touch, and, like, I just didn't know that that wasn't the same thing. I do now, and it's so obvious to me now, I was, I don't know, 14 at the time, right? But, like, I want my son to know that very early on, that, like, hey, like, outside of being told like what this is, like, you're not going to necessarily know these things. And society as a whole tells us really bad narratives about how to interpret those things, to Chloe's mm-hmm. point that she's brought up. I also mm-hmm. think that there was something earlier that you were talking about, that like there will still be things that maybe go wrong or experiences that are bad. And I think a lot of times, especially when it comes to people in marginalized sexual identities, there is almost this hesitancy to bring up something bad that happened, because it gets used or gets weaponized to say that this identity is a problem, right? Like, oh, I had a really bad experience with a guy, so like obviously that's a sign that, you know, my sexuality is a problem. And we don't do that the other way around. We don't have a heterosexual encounter and then blame heterosexuality, but I do think that it gets blamed oftentimes on other more marginalized sexual identities. And talking about the fact that problems can still happen is a really important piece of that conversation. I really appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. That's so important.
So I think one of the things that I was curious to ask you two together, having you both here, is like how the relationship and conversations around sex and sexuality like change as those stages of relationship change, right? When you talk about that, you know, 0 to 12 year old range, and then that, like, my son is 10, 11, and he's already like, I don't want to talk to you, Dad. I want to talk to my friends about it, about pretty much everything. And then obviously, like, once, you know, kiddos are out of the house and you guys are both adults, how were those changes for you guys as that relationship changed?
Why don't you talk about that, Chloe?
Yeah. I mean, it's, to be honest, it's hard to like remember back to being young. So I feel like you'll be able to speak to the younger experiences. I think it's been, so I'll let you talk about that, but I think it's been really interesting to watch as these conversations shift post being out of the house, and as we both are kind of becoming more peer level in our conversations. I think it's been a really cool evolution for us. I have been through relationships, breakups, whole identity shifts, all of that in my 20s and now 30s. And it's created invitation for us to reestablish our relationship when it comes to this stuff. Just as an example, in the past, it's probably like 7 or 8 months, I left a partnership that was really, really toxic and abusive. And I came out as bisexual when I was like 11, but had been in these heterosexual relationships for a long time. And I ended this relationship. It was gnarly. I had some real wounds. And I was like, I've never been more queer in my life. Like, I am never doing that again. I am all queer all the time, posting about it on Instagram, like, all for it. And my mom was like, whoa, like, we haven't talked about your queerness in a while. You seem to be going a little gung-ho. And she was like pretty nervous about that. And it was a really important thing for us to go through, right? Because it felt like all of a sudden I was 12 years old and my mom was telling me it was a phase and I was hurt. And I was like, you're not seeing me. But what that did is it allowed us to talk about it in totally different places than we were when I was 11, 12 years old, and be able to talk about like, yeah, okay, this is, how do we navigate an adult relationship with major transformations happening? And we navigated it really beautifully, I would say. Like, I feel like we're stronger now than we've ever been. And that all started with those conversations when I was young that were so open. It's like, we just have been building this safe space for so long that now it's like, we can really rumble in it, bring some heavy shit in there, and we do it and we come through it and are stronger. So that's the piece I can speak to, but I would love to hear about the younger conversations. I don't remember.
Chloe has always been very expressive and very tactile. And I can even as a little person, like keeping clothes on. We lived in California we'd go visit California a lot. Her brother was born there, but she was born up here. And we'd go down there, and the minute we were in weather, her clothes were all off. And she just always wanted to hold your hand and all those things. And she has just always been that way. And I can remember when she was probably, I don't know, 12, 13, or 14, and saying, Phoebe, if you find yourself really caring for somebody, it's going to be really important that that person is a touchy person too, because I don't want anybody making you feel bad because you like to touch. Because it's not about your weakness, it's about your strength that you like to touch. But you got to be with somebody that understands that and isn't saying you're so clingy or something stupid like that, you know? Yeah, it feels like a lot of how we had conversations when she was growing up was really easy. But it's funny because this last piece, she was acting a bit 12 all of a sudden all over again. And I was like, so how do we put together this person and this person at the moment? Because, and it really was, it just felt like, to me, kind of like a minor glitch, you know? She's just like, Mom, I need you to chill out, you know? And I need you to let this part of me that has been really tucked away, I want it to be a bigger part of who I am. And I'm like, that's a great, good, okay, let's do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, Chloe has always done a lovely job in picking really loving people to be friends with and loyal people to be friends with. And so that part was just, you know, because she was coming out of something that I had a sense I wanted her out of sooner. and I think I was just like, let's not step into anything that's hurtful again. That was more my bigger concern. And that, you know, she's picks lovely people most of the time. So.
Yeah. I don't pick the best cis straight men, but we're working we're picking other people
the
now.
The selection there in that category is limited.
Yeah, it's limited.
It is.
I think I really relate to Chloe, like what you're saying, as a person who came out as bi when I was 30, I guess, to a few people, and then over the, you know, couple years after that to more and more people, and now to everybody except for my parents. But you know, it's on the internet, so I'm sure they know. It does feel like there is a really relatable aspect to what you talked about, because I remember texting Matthew Ball Turner, who I don't know if you guys know, MPT. He was a guest on the podcast, and I texted him and I was like, I feel like I'm 14. Like when it comes to any type of gay experience I have, I go to a gay club and I feel like a 13-year-old at their first dance. And it is weird to be 30 and feeling those types of like very prepubescent types of emotional experiences. And so I just wanted to say that's really fucking relatable.
100%. I feel like I'm going through puberty again. Like, it's,
I love this.
It's very fun and also so awkward.
Yeah.
I have a question, and I'm just curious your thoughts, because I think that when it comes to parenting and in kind of the conversations that we've been having, I've spent a lot of time like wondering how I define success as a parent. Because I think it's a lot different than how maybe my parents or my parents' generation defined success. And I think that, you know, I've had conversations with people, and I had a good friend say, that their definition, and I don't think they would mind me sharing this, their definition would be like, if they could come back later, if their child could come back later in life and talk about like the ways that they had messed up, and it could be like a healthy conversation. But I think for a long time, I was like, I had this fear, like, what am I going to do while my kids are little that's going to put my kids in therapy? Until my therapist was like, why is it such a bad thing that they'll be in therapy? if they're in therapy, that's a great thing. And I just also like being able to hang out and spend time with you and like, you know, here, Chloe, I feel like you did say like, that was the thing that put me in therapy, you know, and you guys are be able to like joke about it and just openly talk about like, Tina, your definition of success was not like this quote unquote, like I have to be perfect and never make a mistake as a parent. And I'm just curious, like, how did you, like, what was that? Did you have that in your mind? Like how you define success? And I don't know if that makes sense.
You know, I think I was pretty committed, I would actually say very committed, to giving it my best shot. And that for me meant doing a lot of, there was a lot of trauma in my relationship with my mom. I had a really solid dad, which was a godsend, honestly, but a lot of difficulty with my mom. And there's a lot of stuff there that I needed to overcome. Because she was, you know, pretty borderline and very, very difficult, I ended up meeting Chloe's father literally within months of my mom remarrying somebody, and I lost my job as her caretaker, in essence. And then I ended up marrying somebody who needed me in a similar kind of way. There was a kind of a mirror thing going on there. And so there's a lot of things that happened that were sort of errors in my own life, but because my childhood had been challenging in that way with my mom, I really wanted to do what I could to learn, you know, like learn things, go to therapy. I started going to therapy when I was dating her father, you know, we would go to therapy, you know, like I just knew that there was a lot to do. And all of that stuff took time, you know? And so meanwhile, there were things I think I did really well, and then there were things that I didn't do very well. And so I would echo what this friend said, because when I look at our lives now, with Chloe in her early 30s and her brother's almost 37, it's the fact that we can have really hard conversations about things that were painful a long time ago, or things that even have been painful more recently, we can sit and talk about them. And I am so proud of how emotionally intelligent my children are. Like they're non-reactive. They will hold their own. They will tell me what, and we will sit and we might all be crying, you know, but it's so kind and thoughtful and respectful and honest. And we're better on the other side of every single one of those conversations. And I feel like that's where my good parenting, if it's anywhere, if it's showing up anywhere, it's the fact that we can do that so well together. And we love each other so much, but we aren't going to trade ourselves in for the other kind of a thing, you know? And I have said that many times. I'm like, wow, they're more emotionally intelligent than I am, certainly than I was at that age, but even sometimes I am now. And I'm like, that's where my best parenting, because I did invest a lot in their emotional intelligence. I mean, we talked through stuff, you know, like I had a conversation with their brother when he was 14, you know, and he was smoking pot, and I'm like, and he was worried about one of his friends. And I said, so at what point are you going to be worried enough about this friend that you might want to talk to him about it? Or you might want to talk to me about it, or you might want to talk to his mom about it, or you, whatever. I mean, we talked through everything that was, not everything, because obviously your kids are going to keep things to themselves, but a lot of things we talked through together. And I don't think I hardly ever raised my voice. That's just not who I am in the world. That's not a pat on my back. I'm just not that person. I just don't go there. I'm not very reactive.
I love that.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
You have thoughts on that, Chloe?
No, I love it. Like that feels exactly correct. And I think there was such a focus on showing up authentically that like we weren't going to bullshit each other. Like, we were going to show up even at our worst and know that the questions you would ask us would be to help us process. Like, it was never like directed statements, right? Like, how dare you do this? It would be like, so walk me through this. Like, let's talk about it. And now, I mean, I feel like I just like therapy myself and other people all the time, because that's just like how we processed everything all the time. That feels like how you parented. Is you were just like, we're going to process everything all the time so that you know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. And there was a joke in our house that I have to tell you guys, because the joke was, you've got me as a mom, so you don't have a college fund. You have a therapy fund, because you're going to need it someday, because you've got me. And I am so different than every other parent that you're running into, you know? Except for her aunt is probably the closest parent to me, my sister.
Yeah, well, good luck finding a therapist that can therapy us when we come and we're like, so I've already processed through everything and I've already asked every question. Like, the amount of therapists that tell me, like, wow, you're really self-aware. Like, I know. I know this. So how do we move forward?
Because I still have stuff to do.
Yeah. I love that. And it just feels like you guys prioritize the relationship. And I think that that's where, like, you know, my relationship with my parents isn't great, because the relationship isn't the priority. It is right behavior. It's being the right person. And I'm not that person. So we therefore don't have a relationship, which is unfortunate, because I think there's so much that gets missed, because I can't share my whole self with my parents. So it's really beautiful to see that you guys can do that. It's awesome. And I hope that, you know, for my relationship with my kid.
Yeah. I would say that that's really kind of nailing it, Cortland, because, you know, I was more concerned about finding ways to talk about a hard thing in a way that preserves the relationship than I was dealing with the hard thing that they were going through, you know, being like, how could my child do that? Or it's like, your job description, you're being perfectly 15 or perfectly 17 or perfectly 25 or perfectly 30, whatever. You're being perfectly that. But what I want is for this to be okay, which means that, like Chloe said, that we just try to show up authentically and we struggle through it together and we trust each other in it. And how wonderful. I mean, my kids are the most, I have a lot of things that I love and am passionate about, but nothing comes close to my kids and my grandkids, not even close. And they know that.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Awesome. Well, we're kind of getting to the part of the show where we want you to plug your stuff and where people can find you and interact with you. So, Tina, if you want to go first, you have a couple books to plug.
I do. I have Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy, which I wrote because I got exposed to so many students, grad students, and clients who came to the purity movement, and it broke my heart. So I did the research and wrote that book. So I spent 11 years writing that book, and I'm really grateful that it's out there helping people. And then I had so many people after that who came to me and said, I don't want to do to my kids what was done to me, but I don't know what to do. Can you help? And I said, I can do that. I've been teaching this stuff forever. And so I put together Shameless Parenting, Everything You Need to Raise Shame-Free Confident Kids and Heal Your Shame Too. The new edition just came out like 2 weeks ago. So it's got updated resources at the end of every single chapter, birth to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 6, all the way up to 18. Nice. And that's really just there to, you know, help, really hold people's hand as they're doing each little step along the way, so that they can have adolescents who want to stay connected to them. And that's what research shows, that if you're a really good sex educator with your kids, there's a much stronger likelihood that they'll want to stay connected to you through their adolescence. So, and I want that for every parent, because I really think parents can be a great resource for their kids, but they've got to be okay with their kids being kids, you know, and doing what kids do. So, otherwise you can follow me on, Dr. Tina Shameless on Instagram. And if you, for people who are clinicians of any type. I have an institute that does training in sexual health and knowing your sexual biases, and that's NW for Northwest. So NW Institute on Intimacy at Instagram, and you can learn about us there and find us in other ways. Yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Where can people find you, Chloe?
I don't have a big.
Do you want people
presence,
to find you? I guess is the first question.
Yeah, if you want.
I mean, yeah. So I'm a freelance copy editor. So I specifically work on stuff in this world, in, you know, sexuality, spirituality, mysticism, sexual health, all of that stuff. You can find me at The Grammar Grimoire on Instagram, or email me at thegrammargrimoire@gmail.com. And that's how you can hire me to edit your amazing books or websites or blogs, whatever.
Awesome. She's really incredible. She's really, really, she's edited everything I've written and still write. So I don't know what I'd do without her.
That's awesome. You guys are the best. I'm just so grateful that both of you took the time to be with us, and I've enjoyed this conversation thoroughly. I so enjoyed hanging out with you last year when we got to hang out, and I can't wait until I get to do that again, just like Megan gets the privilege of doing way more often because she's in a cool part of the country where there's all kinds of cool people all the time. So one of these days we'll reconnect, and it'll be great. Megan. Well,
thank you, guys. Fun.
Before we wrap, I have to say how lovely it was to see you both sing Alanis Morissette at karaoke during the Portland meetup that we had. It was, I don't know if I've ever seen a mother-daughter duo sing You Ought to Know. I think it was probably You Ought to Know, right?
Yeah. It felt normal to me, but we got a lot of feedback that it was a groundbreaking experience. So.
It was a moment. Honored and privileged to be there for you.
I have to tell you, Chloe got a karaoke machine for Christmas. Maybe that was the inspiration.
There you go. Well, yeah, thanks so much for coming on. And I am sure so much of what you said is going to resonate with our listeners. So this has been a really great time. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun for us, for me. I'm sure for Chloe too.
Yeah, me too.
All right.
Yeah, they're amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I thoroughly enjoyed that episode, and I've already had, since we recorded that, three separate conversations with people who we were talking about something that kind of related. And I was like, oh my God, this episode's coming out. Like, I'm going to send it to you as soon as it comes out. So like, I already have a few people specifically that I'm going to let know that this is out there, because I just think that it's really relevant for so many people.
Yeah, for sure. I loved every minute of it. I have known Dr. Tina for a while, since our Clubhouse days, and we get to hang out sometimes, which is amazing. And I just, I love everything that they had to say. So, and it was great to get to know Chloe too. I'm so grateful for them and what they shared and all of their insight and wisdom in all of this.
Yeah. Yeah, me as well. So let's let folks know where they can connect with us. I want to, you know, bring up, as we do lots of times, I was having a conversation. I got to hang out with another podcaster, TJ from the Church GMs Now podcast. He came out to Denver we got to hang out. It was a really good time. And we were talking about podcasting and talking about reviews. And I was saying, I don't think I've left my review over on the Church GMs Now podcast. And I know how much that means. I know how important it is to podcasters and to getting the word out about a show. And I'm a listener, and I was a guest. So I this week, I'm going to go leave my Church Jams Now review. If you are a listener and you want to help support what we're doing, we, of course, have the Patreon. And that is a way you can tangibly support what we're doing. You can join and then get access to the Discord server and the various things that we're going to be doing with our patrons over the coming year. But if you don't have the resources to do that and you still want to support what we're doing, leaving a podcast review on Apple Podcasts or giving us a rating on Spotify, which you can only do through the mobile version. If you're a Spotify listener on your mobile app, you can give a 5-star rating. Those two things help a lot, just helping to signal to those platforms that we have listeners, that people like what we're saying, and it can help us get a little bit more visibility on a platform where there's lots of podcasts out there. So want to throw that out there. Megan, where can people find you and connect with you as well as the show on social media and the web as a whole?
Yeah, you can find me at The Pursuing Life in all the places. And you can find the show on Instagram at Thereafter Podcast and on Twitter at Thereafter Pod. And we have our Patreon, and we would love to have folks join that. We have a Discord that's connected, starting to be connected with that. There's people already in it, which is great. People jumped in when we opened it up, and now we're going to start to link them more together and do a little bit more through there. Cortland, tell us the Patreon and where people can find you.
Yeah, it's patreon.com/thereafterpod. And you can find me at Cortland Coffee on Twitter, primarily still these days, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. I'm the only Cortland Coffee out there, extremely Googleable for better or for worse. So find me any of those places. And I love connecting with people. I am sometimes a little socially overwhelmed. So if you shoot me a DM or something and you don't hear back from me, never worry about bugging me too much. I'm happy to connect with people. Sometimes it may take a couple times, but really grateful, especially for folks who listen to the podcast and want to connect about it. So yeah, connect with me around the web, connect with Megan, and tune in to our Twitter spaces every Tuesday. It's another great way to be able to stay connected. And you don't have to sign up for anything to be able to do that. Just log into Twitter any Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. Pacific time.
All right. I think that's a wrap. Until next time.
Until then.